Okay, hello everyone. We are here. This is our fourth class on the rescue of the Mir Yeshiva. It was supposed to be the last class, but I think we're going to have a fifth one. We had an enormous amount of people listening, averaging about 130. In fact, I'm going to turn off this light so I don't know. Hundred thirty, and as many, I think, as listening afterwards. I've been getting a lot of questions and a lot of comments. So before we, if you recall, we ended last class, and we were in Shanghai. We just made it to Shanghai. In many respects, getting to Shanghai is more interesting than being in Shanghai. But a number of comments and questions last time, I just want to answer before we go forward. In particular, a number of, I can't deal with all the people who commented to me, but some of them were quite important, especially with regard to the role of Chabad and the situation in Shanghai. So let me spend a few minutes answering that, and then we'll continue. Oh, and I'm going to say something about the Amshin over Rebbe as well. We'll begin with that. I want to show you people a document. Before I get to that, a number of you found the video we watched at the end there very interesting with Rav Tzvi Kahana. I hadn't even remembered it. I watched it again, and I remember Tzvi Kahana was the one who gave the first images. He spoke in his memoir of what it was like arriving in Shanghai, and that they didn't even realize that what Sephardic Jews were. They thought they were going to look like Chinese people. And then I showed you the video of him. And so a number of people, I don't want to get this only because it's really not that relevant. I'll just say that in response to so many emails, watched the video again. The first time I've seen it in a long time. And I didn't even remember. I told you it was his wife who asked for the bracha, which she did, but he also asks for the bracha. And if you haven't seen it and you know Hebrew, I encourage you all to watch it because you'll see the Rebbe in rare form. And I'll just, I mean, when Ritzvi Kahana says that I'm asking for the B'nai Torah, the Rebbe says, not B'nai Torah. Because if they're B'nai Torah, they wouldn't be interested in Machlokas. And I think most would agree that with the Rebbe, that when the Rebbe says there's thousands of Jewish kids in Israel with no getting any Jewish education, and yet these people, does this bother them? They have not, that doesn't bother them. They don't go out, don't care about that. What bothers them is that the Chabad is not sleeping in the sukkah. And so it's a very powerful moment. One of you asked me about how many Jews were there before the Mir students arrived. There were 25,000 Jews approximately. You had about 1,000 before World War I. And then you, after the revolution, a number of other thousand more arrived, and then Germans and Austrians came in. Okay. Oh, and finally, one of you found it shocking, the prostitution figures. So we don't need to go back into that. But when I said 47% Vilna, Vilna was basically 50% Jewish. The whole point of this is that the Jews, there was such a collapse in Jewish society that the Jews were no different in criminal pursuits and everything else. As the non-Jews. For those who don't know what I'm talking about, you can listen to the last three classes. Okay, before we go on, this is very important about the situation with Chabad. A number of you wanted me to elaborate on this. I'm gonna show you a document now. I'm gonna pull up the screen. Now, let me explain a little bit about this before we continue. Let me share my screen here. If you recall, I explained the, well, hold on, I got to pull it up again, the document here. Okay, let's hope I can get this up for you now. What I'm going to show you now is a document that is from the end of the war. And there's a number of copies of it, but it's, and I want to explain, if, just to recall for everyone, let's see, can you see the document? Shake your head. Okay. Let me tell you what this document says. If you remember, the issue was the money that was sent by Vatsala. It wasn't just Vatsala, by the way. The Jew also sent money. We'll speak about that. But Vatsala. And the question was who this should go to. Should you just go to, and this became a big machokes because money was only being given to the yeshiva students and not the Chabad. And I said last class that I'm going to get into the debate. We know that the Lubavitch raised their own money, their own Vad Hatzalah, so we can understand what was going on. I mentioned that there was a Din Torah. I'll get back to that in a second after the war. But this document, which I'll enlarge a bit, something looks like it's been getting out in the middle. I'm not sure, but I'll just tell you what this is a document in 1945 from Shanghai in which they write to Gerari. That's the son-in-law of the Friedeker Rebbe. And it explains the whole situation. I'm happy to send this document to anyone there. And it says Rav Aaron Kotler's name is never mentioned here. It's important because Rav Aaron Kotler, in Chabad's memory, has a reputation as a very evil person for what he did to them. And yet he's never mentioned. All Rabbi Kalmanovitz. So without getting into the Chabad dispute with Rav Aaron Kotler, we should know that I have no evidence to accuse him of this, even if he... Without getting into the issue, which I'll explain a little more, aside from that, Aaron Kotler might have the reputation of being anti-Chabad, and yet we know, I'm going to read you something in a little bit from someone whose father was there, and other examples, we don't really have much in the way of really on anti-Chabad like we see in the 1970s. But just, I'll tell you what the letter says. It mentions that... you know, the care packages would come, and they come into two places. They come in, it seems that at first they were coming into Rav Meir Ashkenazi, who's the Chabad rabbi, and then when there were problems with the Meir Ashkenazi, because he was distributed to everyone, then they sent it to Rav Chaim Shlevitz. In fact, let me show you before I even get to that, I'm going to show you a different document now, before I show you that one. Document a telegram from Meir Ashkenazi. She sent in, and this I have to give credit, I knew nothing about this. David Safier, is that pronounced name? I hope, who has done unbelievable work at the Yeshiva University archives that have the Vad Hatzalah archive. Most of the Vad Hatzalah archives we know from Ephraim Zuroff's book, which I will talk about. We could maybe see a little bit here. We'll talk about this at the very last thing, because Ephraim Zuroff's work has been accused of being nothing less than a blood libel. We'll talk about that. But David sent me this. He discovered this as well as other important things. This is a completely unknown document, and you can read it. I'm enlarging it for you. We don't have the date on the document, but it's sometime, I would guess, 1943 or 44. And this is a telegram from... called a radiogram, because that's a telegram that was sent not by through the wires, but over the radio waves. It says, Vad Hatzalah supports addressed to me are distributed all, it says Benest, it should be B'nai Torah, including Lubliner and Chabad equally, Rabbi Meir Ashkenazi. And this is the issue. Rabbi Meir Ashkenazi insisted on distributing to all the B'nai Torah. That's not just to the Meir, but also to Chabad and to Lubliner. And here we have the evidence of this. I mean, we knew the evidence because it went to a Din Torah. But here we actually have his telegram to the Vad Hatzalah telling them that he's not going to make any differences. What this led to, this seems to be how it worked, is what it led to is to send it directly then to Rav Chaim Shmulevitz. We'll hear more about him today. And here is the letter, and in the letter it says, it talks about how the care packages were sent, and it, let me pull it down here for you, it mentions how in Shavat, I believe this is, I'm not going to go read through the whole letter now, I think this is, refers to 43, it says that money came, But in the telegram from Rabbi Kalmanovitz to Rav Chaim Shmuelovitz, it said to distribute it to all the B'nai Torah except for Chabad. So we see that Rabbi Kalmanovitz did send that. But then what happened is a machokas, because then more monies came, and the money simply said to distribute it B'nai Torah, but it didn't say with it not Chabad. So the argument, the Chabad people said, well, since they didn't specify no Chabad, in these cases we should get, and you can read the letter, it describes the whole dispute there. It mentions how monies came from Rabbi Epstein, this is Ephraim Epstein in Chicago, and how they were, that Rav Chaim Shmuelevitz ended up, after they had an argument here, they ended up, Rav Chaim Shmuelevitz ended up giving it to them as well. The question was, they didn't feel, he didn't feel like they late the instructions of the Masala. It also goes in that the umption over being supported by this money, he was not a yeshiva student, and they fight over this. So you get a little sense of what's going on here from these letters. Just a few things on this before we go further. Rabbi Isser Zalman Weisberg, he me very passionately that Rav Aaron Kotler had nothing to do with this, even though this was Rav Kalmanovitz made decisions himself. And I'm not even saying that Rav Kalmanovitz was wrong about this. Someone else points out clearly that this is a dispute that goes back before the war. You had distributions of money, Ezra Torah and others that were sending money. You had Chabad in Vilna, in Dokshitz, and all the other places claiming that they were not getting the money. And finally, something which no one sent me, but I'll read to you. If you read, it shows you the ill feelings. If you look at the Rayatzes, the Friedrich Rebbe's letters, volume 6, page 196, you see how upset he is about this whole thing. He complains that Vad Hatzalah, he calls them Hamadim, because they're not the Hasidim, that they're not giving any money to Chabad. And then he goes off and saying, who gives them the right to act this way? He says, I've always raised money for everyone. Raised money before the war. He says, who supported the yeshivas in Slutsk and Minsk, Kharkov from 1920 to 1927? It was Chabad. He says, He says, I never distinguish between one yeshiva and yeshivas. I've given to all the yeshivas. And then he said, we'll leave it with this. He says, he says, I will never forgive. This is what the Rayat says. I will never forgive these people, these misnagdim, for helping out our yeshiva. And yet, as we said, he had his own yeshiva. I mean, his own phrasing. And to add a little bit interesting aspects, Chabad, Rav Aaron Kotler angle, Rav Schneer Kotler was in Kotler. He actually goes to Eretz Yisrael. He gets out with a number of the other Lithuanian Rosh Yeshivas, and he spends the war with his grandfather, Vissas Al Meltzer. He actually got engaged to a girl right before they left. They were apart now 7 years. He ends up going with Rivaro to Japan. She has a visa to America. She goes to Shanghai. Her name is Rishel. She died about 5 years ago. She becomes terribly ill, tuberculosis or typhus, almost could have died. You know who took care of her? Kept her, watched over her, none other than Rav Meir Ashkenazi, the Chabad rabbi, and the Kotler family, always very appreciative of this. And if I'm not mistaken, one of Rav Schneer's children, I believe, married someone can tell me if I'm correct, married a... I believe they have a son, one son's married a granddaughter of Rav Meir Ashkenazi. So there was really these ill feelings between Rav Aaron and Chabad after the war. We'll get to the ill feelings at the very end, Rabbi Weissmandl and Vad Hatzala. But okay, I could go on and on and on. I hate to say it, that it's this is part of the Chabad legend. They blame Vad Hatzala for the of one or two Chabadnikim in Chai. There was one, I don't know if there was one boy, Chabad boy, who died, but he was very ill. He didn't starve. Okay, I don't want to go on more for this. This is a machlokas. Pavlovich knows about this. Okay, I want to just pick up one. You asked me about the Amshanova Rebbe. I showed his pictures a few times. You know, he moved to America, and he always wants to go there to serve. He dies in America. He's from an older dynasty. Two Amshanovas now. Unfortunately, one of the Amshanovas over in New York died of corona not long ago. But the Amshanova in Jerusalem is famous because they're the ones that David, they could do shachris at 4 in the afternoon, all this crazy stuff now in terms of this money. But he was a great tzaddik, the Amshanova. I've spoken about for a bit. He has to go down history as a great person for many reasons. I mean, he had no distinction. He was in Shanghai. He'd go to the irreligious, the religious. Everyone loved him. But he was the one, because he was a Chassidic Rebbe, he was able to have an influence on the Chassidim, Chachmei Lublin and others, and he urged them, you have to take the visas. You have to go. So we have to thank him. Okay, let us pick up where we were left off now, last class. So the last thing we left off with was arrival in Shanghai. We spoke about the shul. Someone emailed me, we get into Shanghai, because anyways, the story of getting to Shanghai is more interesting. But we arrived in Shanghai last class. We spoke about what they were learning. You can listen to it online, everything. Of course, they were being supported throughout by the Vaad Hatzala and by the joint with money going. I meant also through Sweden. I mentioned Uruguay. Uruguay actually makes ties with the Axis. 1943, I believe, end of 42, and after that, no money can be sent directly from Uruguay to Shanghai. So instead, it goes from America to Uruguay and into Argentina. There was a Rabbi Klein in Argentina, and it was sent. And believe it or not, in 1943, joint is given permission by the State Department. You can read all about Kranzler's book, to once again, for humanitarian purposes, the Red Cross was involved with, and money to Shanghai, and the Japanese government allowed it. But the Vaad Hatzala money did not go that way. It went different routes, and it was illegal, the money they were getting. The last thing we mentioned was, I told you about how the students, driving with the rickshaw drivers, and Rav Levinstein tells them, go with the rickshaw drivers, make sure you give them a good tip, because that's how they make their living. So it's a shock, this new phenomenon of Shanghai. We have enough descriptions of what it was like in Shanghai at the synagogue there, the learning, Beth Aron, Beth Aron. You recall the Beth Aron synagogue because Silas Hardoon, he has this dream, wants to know how he could, his father says, you haven't honored me, how are you going to honor me? So he decides to build a synagogue to honor him. We have a description of the yeshiva during the Shanghai period, which describes how the sounds of Torah went out from the building and went and made an impression on all the people in outside. Remember, we saw that this was in the area of the international district, the business district, with lots of hustle and bustle, and this was countered by the study of Torah all day. In fact, Rav Shmuel Berenbaum, who would later come to America and become Rosh Yeshiva in Brooklyn, he described, and he's not the only one, we have a number of descriptions of the, which is almost counterintuitive, as describing the yeshiva's time in Shanghai as the glorious days. And the general consensus was that this was, if not the height, not the highest level, the equal of anything that the Mir Yeshiva had been in Europe. We have a letter from Rabbi Malin, Leib Malin. We've spoken a good deal about him. Leib Malin, he was already in his 30s, so someone said, you call him a student. What a number of these people were already in your early 30s. And if I think about it, the reason perhaps they were able to go against the Rosh Yeshiva and urge that we have to get out of here was because these were not 18-year-olds. These were not 20-year-olds. You had a number of them who were already older, even married people, and they were not so inclined to go along just because the Torah said that they have to remain. We have a letter from Blaine. You can see it in the book, Azricha, here, the story of the one of the Amir Yeshiva, on page 1215. Let me read you what Rabbi Malin says. This is writing at the end of the war. It's slave. So December 1945 from Shanghai. He writes to Rav Kalmanovich explaining what it was like. He says, if you had been here, you would have seen, he says, Nochal Amar, we can say that with all the difficulty in Shanghai, nothing changed. Unishtanta kum, nothing changed in our way of learning from what it had been before. He says, if you had come here for one day, you'd get great joy, and you'd see that, he says, worth coming here just to see how incredible it was, and nothing changed. Learning remained the way it was. The students followed the same pattern they had in Europe. So, for instance, they all studied the same masakta, the same tractate. When the yeshiva was still in Kobe, Rav Kalmanovich sent them tractate Kiddushin, a couple hundred copies of Kiddushin, because that was what they were going to be learning. Remember, Rav Kalmanovich, who had come to America and being made honorary president of the Mir Yeshiva, he raised all the money, and then he continues, of course, after the war and establishes the Mir in Brooklyn. When it was time for the next tractate to be studied, when they were done with Kiddushin, due to the war, they couldn't get it shipped from the United States. Not having any choice, they decided to print their own copies. And in May 1942, after they printed Gittin, which was the next tractate they're going to be learning, there was a big celebration at the Jewish Club. All these places used to have like Jewish clubs, these different cities. And they had it at the Jewish Club. Those of you went with us to Morocco, and we went to one of the Jewish clubs in Casablanca, where you can eat there, and you can, actually that one has, I don't know if the Jewish Club in Shanghai sports or anything, but it was, that's what had it. It was in honor of printing 250 copies of tractate. And yes, this was the first of over 100 Torah volumes that are printed in Shanghai. If you do the numbers, you come to tens of thousands of copies. And not only the Mir Yeshiva had printed, Chachmei Gur printed, these books they printed, and we have an entire list of everything that's been printed in the periodical Hamayan a few years ago. Hogus. This included the entire Talmud, three Yavamos. Why not Yavamos? Well, when they left Europe, when they left to Japan, the Masechta they were studying was Yavamos. Everyone had a Yavamos that they brought along with them. So they didn't need to reprint it. We have seen some copies of Kiddushin. Apparently, they weren't sent enough. And that's why when they reprinted the Masechtas, they reprinted Kiddushin as well. But almost every Bacher had a copy of it, so it didn't need to be printed. So how did they reprint it? Shanghai, incidentally, was a center of printing, legal printing. Copyright meant nothing there. They had a system of photo offset. Anything you want to print, it was very easy. So, I mean, if you want to print a copy of any novel or anything, you care. There was like no law in that city. But how are you going to print the Gemara? Turns out one of the old Sephardic residents had a copy of the Vilna Shas. And he gave it to him to print. I don't know if he used it or if it was just something he had, but generous to give it to them. And it had to be destroyed. Through the printing, they had to actually take each page out and destroy it. But that's where it came. And let me just show you a copy of the title page of one of the masas that went on auction a few years ago. That's where I got the copy for the picture. Here you can see it. This is it says Shanghai. So this is Marcus Bechorot. They needed the yeshiva, even if the yeshiva as a group never learned Bechorot, they still needed to print a number of copies in the base medrash for the library, for people to use, etc. And this is just the Vilna Shas reprinted. These are, of course, rare volumes now, if you can get a Shanghai copy. Can you hear me now? Is everything sound? Someone said the sound wasn't so good.
It's not as good as usual, for sure. I don't know what the issue is exactly. They say sometimes if you make a phone connection, I don't know how to do that exactly, but maybe that works better. I don't know if your internet's down a little. I mean, we can hear you, but every once in a while it does have a slight breakup. It's not quite as clear as it usually is.
Yeah. Okay, I see that. Well,
make sure everybody's muted, because if anybody's unmuted, the slightest sound is going to interfere or get an echo. So make sure you mute everybody.
Everybody, I believe.
Everyone's muted. It could be my internet for some reason.
It's also better if everybody stops their video. That's what I've been told on other Zoom sessions. It helps.
Okay, if people want to take out their video, and then you can come back later.
Yeah, okay, so everybody can turn off their video.
We can take off your video and you can come back later. Okay, let's hope. We have had this problem before. Until now, everything has been great. So I don't know. I muted everyone. Okay, we'll do our best. They also printed Mishnah. They printed the Mishnah Bura. They printed all sorts of works. Not only there were two Yiddish newspapers, Agudas Yisrael printed, and all sorts of other things. And life was good, I guess you could say, in Shanghai. And in February of 1943, February 18th, a decision was made by the Japanese government. And anyone who's been to Shanghai knows what I'm referring to. All Jewish refugees who had come to Shanghai beginning in 1937, not if you came before 37, beginning of 37, and who were now regarded as stateless, because if you came from Germany, you weren't stateless. You still you had a passport, but you came from Poland. You had no you had nothing, actually. I take that back. Germans also, they removed their citizens. Poland, of course, there was no country Poland. They were all put into a certain section, a nice section of Shanghai, a poor and crowded city. It was a ghetto, an actual ghetto. They were all put there. They had to go there. And we'll get to the Arba meeting in a second. And for some reason, Chaim Shmulevitz was given permission to remain outside the ghetto. But all the rest of them had to go to the ghetto. That includes all the yeshiva students, the other refugees, the people who came in the early 30s, German and Austrians who came then were allowed to stay where they were. But anyone after 37, yes.
Mark, this is Dov. My father lived in the international neighborhood. He was never in the ghetto. We visited the street he was on. They've changed the name from French to Chinese. It used to be called Cardinal Mercier. And he had to deal with people who crossed the Po River after the curfew and represented them to the Japanese, who beat the hell out of them. But that's a whole other story.
This is Dov Zakheim?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to speak. I have to mute you. I'm going to speak about Dov Zakheim's father and his role. I didn't even know you were going to be on, but I was going to talk about that anyway, about his role in Shanghai. So he also did not have to go to the ghetto. If you go to Shanghai today, you see the area and you see the actual buildings where Jews lived with Chinese. And they are going to be tearing this down. I don't know if it's going to be in 10 years or 20 years, but the plan is to tear it down and make nice apartments and whatever they're going to make there. But when you go there today, you can really get a sense of what it was like to live there. After the war, the German consul of Tianjin, it's a nice size city, revealed that the internment of Jews in the ghetto was done at the instigation of the German authorities. At the time, we have the memoir of one of the mere students who recorded his feelings about hearing the order to move into the ghetto. He said as follows: here is a nation, namely the Jews, that for thousands of years did not know what a Jew was. Here's a nation, the Japanese, that for thousands of years did not know what a Jew was. It only met him 3 years ago, and it already hates the Jew. as we spoke about in previous classes, although there was Japanese in important positions who wanted to cultivate good relations with the Jews, many of them became anti-Semites and were convinced of Jewish imperialism and Jews are controlling the American government and all sorts of things. In fact, David Saber sent me the telegram, Mayor Ashkenazi sent me some stuff from one of the English newspapers in Japan, anti-Semitism. That's what we spoke about, Professor Koji, how he got in trouble as he stood up for the Jews. This statement made by the student was about the Japanese, not the Chinese, who were themselves under Japanese control. Quite apart from being in the ghetto, there was a widely believed report. And I was told this by my Rebbe when I was in high school, Rabbi Shlomovitz, so I mentioned he was one of the Mir students, that, and this was known by all the Mir students, it was published after the war, Yechezkel Levenstein mentions this, it's in his published sermons, that due to German prodding, there was a Japanese plan to murder all the Jews of Shanghai by sending them out on ships into the ocean and sinking them. But there is no evidence of this, although this is repeated again and again. Kranzler denied this. You have some sources that mention this, that supposedly it came from the Japanese vice consul in Shanghai. But if you actually go to the documents, the document we have describing the meeting, and you can read it in Kranzler, there's no mention there of murder. There's only mention of the possibility of confining the Jews in the ghetto or sending them to an island. I know that after the war, people who claim to either have been at the meeting or heard from people at the meeting say that he report him saying that there was a plan to murder the Jews. But if you look at the written record from after the meeting, that doesn't appear. That's all I could say. And there was also later on, it became extended that they talked about a plan to murder the Jews with poison gas. Obviously, the Nazis wanted to kill the Jews, but there's no evidence that there's anyone of significance in the Japanese government who was inclined to follow Germany's lead. Okay, so the Jews are put into the ghetto, the students, mere students. The problem is the synagogue, Beth Aron, where the yeshiva is, that's outside the ghetto area. And thus a new site had to be found for the yeshiva. The Japanese wanted to put the students, there was a Salvation Army building that was like falling apart. They wanted to put them there. It wasn't suitable. It even led to not just tension, like a mini riot of the Mir students and between the Mir students and the Japanese appointed Jewish organization, I guess the Judenrat, if you want to call it that, of the Jews in Shanghai. There was a Jewish group in charge of the refugees. 33 students from the Mir Yeshiva were placed in jail for their rioting because it was completely unsuitable, unsanitary, everything. And you can read the descriptions of how terrible this place was there to be put. Rabbi Ashkenazi was able to get them released, I'm assuming the old-fashioned way, namely through bribery. For reasons that we don't know, the Japanese government had a change of heart, maybe also bribery, whatever, and it permitted the yeshiva to remain in Beth Aron. And the students given a pass so that they could leave the ghetto to go to the yeshiva. All this money, you know, that's spent on the yeshiva students, on buying books, on who knows what else. Just remember this money because we're going to see more examples of it. And then we'll get an appreciation why after the war, people were very critical of Hatzalah because this is money that could have been used to rescue Jews. We're going to see what Ephraim Zuroff had to say later. I'll tell you about Erlei Weissmandel. Okay, that's the 2020. But obviously, enormous amounts of money were being sent, not just Vod Hatzalah, from joint as well. Rabbi Lichtenstein, the question was, okay, let's say on Shabbos, you want to go to the yeshiva for davening and learning. What do you do about the pass? Rav Levenstein actually ruled that it was permitted for a non-Jew to carry the pass on Shabbos for them. So they would have hire non-Jews who would carry the passes with them. And for some reason, yeshiva was treated a lot better than the typical Jews. The Japanese authorities had good relations with the yeshiva. And the permission for the yeshiva to remain outside the ghetto lasted for more than a year. Then in the autumn of 1944, the students were forbidden to leave the ghetto to go to the yeshiva. So they had to be relocated into the ghetto. At first they, well, one of the places they put that was, wasn't big enough for everyone, but people could study there, was the Ashkenazic shul, Ohel Moshe. If you go to Shanghai today, that's where the Jewish Museum is. They call it actually the Shanghai Jewish Refugees Museum. And but eventually they were able to find a former hotel, and this was sufficient for the students' needs. And for the rest of the time in Shanghai, that's where they stayed. Now I see that one of you texted up there. What do they do about the Arba Minim? Good question. The for Pace for Sukkos. We don't have any. No one told, for some reason there's no discussion about Lulav. And Hadassim and Aravos, I guess those were easy to get. They could find them. The Esrog was a problem. Well, at first it wasn't a problem, because if you recall Chacham Abraham, when he came many years before from Bombay, he actually brought an Etrog shoot with him, and he planted it, and he had an Etrog tree in his property, and that's where everyone in Shanghai got their Etrog. However, they were British citizens, as all these Iraqis were. And once Japan entered the war, they were put in civilian prison. Their home was confiscated by the Japanese, and the Etrog tree was uprooted. So what to do about an Etrog? Well, we know that the Mir students were never ones to shy away from difficulties. You recall me telling you last week or the week before about how a couple of them, the Chachmei Lublin students, actually yeshiva students, the journey to all the way to Harbin, which is very far. Remind me at the end. If not, I'll do it at the beginning of next class. Something else from Harbin, from a tshuva, a responsum from Rav Yitzchak Nissen from the early 1950s. A hot question from Harbin. I'll mention that later. But a couple of yeshiva students had been told about a Chinese etrog. What's a Chinese etrog? I'm going to show you a picture of it now. It's called Buddha's Hand. Let me show you a picture of it here, what it looked like. This is the Chinese etrog. Might not look like an etrog, but it's from the same species, and well, they didn't know. They had been told this etrog. It's called a Buddha's hand because the fingers are supposed to resemble, I guess, the fingers, hands. If you look in the Hebrew discussions of this, they refer to it as God's hand. But the Buddha's hand is God's hand. It's not exactly the same thing. But they heard about this sort of citron and I mean, that's where etrogs, I mean, that's where you find them. They come from that part of the world. So they went on this journey. They had been told that there's a city about 200 miles away from Shanghai. And they found it. And they brought it back. When I say they found it and brought it back, they weren't the first ones to find this. People had known about it. The problem is that they had to get it. And they brought it back. And could they use it or not? It was a machlokas. Some of the scholars said yes, others said no, others said use it, don't make a bracha. Now, what do I mean when I say this was already known? It was already known, although I don't know if the Mir scholars knew this, because there was a Iraqi Talmud Chacham named Abdallah Somich. And he has a ranza called Zivchei Tzedek, it's called, published in Baghdad in 1899. And if you look in there, if you want to look at it, it's volume 2, Or HaChaim number 36. He writes, he was asked this question, can you use this etrog? And he rules it's kosher. His Talmud, his student, his Talmud Mufa, the Ben Ish Chai, Rav Yosef, he rules that it's been. So it's a doubt. There was difference of opinion there. If you look in Abdallah Somich's, that's his name, Abdallah. That's a Jewish name also for Arabic speaking Jews. He mentions that the question came to him from the city of He Nun Chaf Aleph Nun. What is He Nun Chaf Aleph Nun? There's a writer wrote about this episode, and he tries to discover what is this referred to, and he says it's a city and somewhere in China, Changshu, which is where they we know the Astrogian word, not true at all. Hey Nun Chaf Aleph Nun is Hong Kong. That's how this Iraqi Jews wrote the word Hong Kong. If you look at the ketubot of Iraqi Jews from Hong Kong, it's written Hey Nun Chaf Aleph Nun. We have a number of Sfarim that were printed in Hong Kong, a few at least. If you look on the title pages, it says Hey Nun Chaf Aleph Nun. So what happened was that the they in Hong Kong, which had a Iraqi community there, Baghdadi community, they got these esrogim. They didn't know what to do with them. They sent them to Abdallah Somech, and he ruled that you can make the bracha on them. And then they and he was disputed by his student. His student, everyone knows, is a Ben Ishchai. In this, is a case where the student is ends up being greater in history than the teacher. A couple other things to mention about the time in Shanghai. The first volume of Torah journal came out called Me'or Torah. Let me show you, where do I have this volume here? I have it somewhere on my, here it is, okay. Here you see it, Me'or Torah. Published, as you can see, in 1944. You can see it on Hebrews.org. Another Torah journal appeared there, Talpiot, which is of interest, because look at this. It's Mukdash Torah V'Chidut. It's for not just Chidushin, Chas, etc., but also Chassidut. And the mere student participated in this. This is from 1945, and you see the end here, you have the issue of, actually 46, is it 45, no, 45, published by a group of rabbinical students. They deal with the issue of Shabbos in Japan. But it's a combination here of Torah literature, of Hasidic stuff. It's not just the Mir Yeshiva, it's everyone who is there. One final Torah to show you that appeared, right, two volumes of this appeared, let me pull it up here, called Torah Or. Let me get my screen here for you, here, second, Torah Or, you see, published in Shanghai, 1946, that gives you the address there, here, two issues appeared. In 1946, the final issue appeared. And on the last page, we find the following. With the close of this issue also closes a special in the life of the yeshiva students in Shanghai. A good number of them have left for Canada and America, and the rest are waiting to leave the city. The story of the B'nai HaYeshivot, the Mir Yeshiva with all of its students, rabbis of Poland and Orthodox community of Shanghai, was one of growth in the study of Torah. As we leave this, we stretch out our hands to God with thanks for the past that he saved us from a horrible destruction and allowed us to occupy ourselves with the study of Torah in this terrible time. Looking back at the yeshiva time in Shanghai, we can't forget that the students were also part of the larger community and they had relationships there, particularly with the Orthodox refugees. A number of Orthodox refugee kids studied in the yeshiva. Some of them even came back after the war to New York. The yeshiva community, and in this I include not just the but the entire community, were also involved in establishing of schools for boys and girls, a new mikvah, kosher restaurant, all things. The Mir students also had relationships with the local Sephardic community, so that they served as tutors, various local children. A number of the Sephardic kids started learning at the Mir, and after the war, some of them came back to America. The yeshiva, one local man, we have written by memoirs. There's a scholar in England who's published a couple volumes, is full of memoirs of Shanghai. One of the people in this memoir recalls the yeshiva, quote, brought new life to our community and raised our religious standards. Of course, if you're going to have this is a typical Sephardic community, and now you have the yeshiva students, obviously going to raise religious standards. It's noteworthy. The memoirs describes also yeshiva students eating at the local Sephardic community people's houses. you know, often we think of yeshiva students, they want to be very strict. They won't eat at the houses, but we know they, at least in houses, they would eat there. Well, some of the young refugees began attending yeshiva out of conviction. For others, there was a practical reason. There's a man, he's still alive. His name is Zygmunt Tobias. I forget where he wrote a memoir of Shanghai. Called Strange Hate. He was a professor. Right? I forget in one of the sciences, but I forget which university. You could easily find the line. He recalls, if you look on page 79, he talks about how while most of the refugees went hungry, the yeshiva students and the families that were involved with the yeshiva, the butter, milk, bottles of cream, and most of the available kosher meat, they appeared much healthier than the rest of us. It was now taken for granted that the yeshivas were receiving from America, money from America. Continues, a number of the other refugee children who joined the yeshiva had been observant at all before life became so difficult. And he speaks about how people would go to the yeshiva just to get a good meal. Now, the fact that the Mir Yeshiva, as well as were receiving from the U.S. means that they were better materially than the other refugees. And Tobias tells us that this led to resentment. He says, I began to hear a great deal of anger and resentment at the yeshivas. Rumors circulated, he says, that the money was coming to Shanghai through Switzerland. The person in the yeshiva was supposed to get only $30 a month. He goes on, did not know what to do or say when the peddler or other refugees imitated the way yeshiva students showed off their new clothes, which they got before the holidays, etc., etc. He goes on, he talks about how, you know, people were very upset and felt bitter that the yeshiva community wanted to buy meat and they couldn't afford it. Some of these people lived, they had these like homes that people had to live supported by the joint. He goes on, during the difficult 4 years, most of the Jewish refugees, whether they were Orthodox, conservative, reform, or not at all religious, often became ill with painful, sometimes deadly diseases because they didn't have enough food. Many refugees were now saying that the people in the yeshiva were hypocrites who hid their greed with religion, yet did not care if other Jews in the ghetto lived or died. People wondered if we would have needed the three cemeteries, which were now almost filled with Jewish refugees who had died in Shanghai, if we had had a little more food during the war. So you get a sense of the resentment that the average person had no one to take care of them. The yeshiva students had people to take care of them. Now, Zuroff, in his book, here's the book, Response of Orthodox Jewry in the United States to the Holocaust. He describes in detail the money sent there. And, you know, the Vatatzel, let's be real, was established in November 1939. Its job was, it raised money to save rabbis and yeshiva students. That was its purpose. And that's what every organization did. The Zionists raised Zionists, and the revisionists rescued labor, the revisionist rescued labor. The idea that you're going to blame the Vat Hatzalah for rescuing yeshiva students, and in Israel, Chief Rabbi Herzog, he got entry permits to Palestine from the British. He used them to rescue great Torah scholars. That's how so many of the great Rosh Yeshiva got out, and their students did not get out. But, I mean, what, is it all supposed to be a lottery here that... I don't see what the criticism is. That's the job of the Vadi Yeshiva. So it's like everything else. If you're a simple person, if you're no one's taking care of you. There were 25,000 people in Shanghai. The yeshiva community, because they were B'nai Torah, they had people raising money for them. Other people, if they wanted to raise money, they could raise money as well. I don't really see this as a criticism. And even Zuroff, and I'll read you something what he wrote, and he was accused of putting forth a blood libel. Zuroff, some of you probably remember from YU, his grandfather was Dean Sar, you recall, from college and then Yeshiva University. If I recall correctly, I think Dean Sar died, collapsed and dropped dead at graduation once at YU. But Ephraim Zuroff, whose most of his life was known as a Nazi hunter, I believe with Simon Wiesenthal or someone else, but he wrote about that. But also wrote, this is his doctoral dissertation, even he admits that November, and by the end of 1940, the Vahdat Salah was actually focused on saving all, not just on yeshiva students. But I do have to say, and I could see the interview is still online, it's worth noting that Zuroff did create a great deal of controversy, because after the book came out, the book itself is not so controversial. It was more the discussions around the book that became controversial, because led to the responses. But Zuroff gave an interview, and the interview is more controversial, created too much more controversy in Israel, in Hebrew, than anything in the book. When he said, when he was asked to talk about lessons and everything from his study of the archives, the Vahdat Salah, etc., he declared that the money that was sent, all this money we've been speaking about, sent from America, Vahdat Salah, to the yeshiva students, should have been used to rescue Jews in Nazi-occupied Europe. As he put it, the Vahdat Salah, which collected money from American Jews in order to rescue Jews of Europe, should have said to the yeshiva students, quote, this is Zuroff, close your Talmuds and go to work. As long as there is a war and millions of Jews are in danger, we need every dollar to rescue people. You know, it's hard to know what to do with this document. You know, we could take every, do we bankrupt ourselves now because we take and maybe save some lives in Africa? It's hard to know. At the end of the day, the migrants were in Shanghai. They needed the yeshiva, they needed books. So you say, like Zuroff says, that no money should them, let them live like everyone else, let them work. And let's not waste money printing Talmuds. Or you could say, well, you know, that's also an expense. I'm not getting involved in that. Just to tell you that it was what he said was called a blood libel. That you know, that they could have used money to, you know, saying that they used the money that they could have been used to Jews. So it's sort of like reverse money, almost money that could have, the Talmud was blood money because they could have used that to save Jews. Be that as it may, you should that was the controversy around that book. And the book, it's not, there's a whole long like a 10-page view of the book you can see online that talks about the book, and then it goes into more pages, I think, about what was the reception history, because the book itself created a huge controversy. It's not just Zuroff, though, I have to say, that Rabbi Weissmandl. Weissmandl was very upset after the war with the Vahdat Salah, because he felt Rabbi Weissmandl was in Slovakia, and he was trying to save Jews there. He felt that printing Talmuds and books and all these things, that this was, when you had money that could have been used to literally save Jews' lives, he thought this was money that was, that Talmud was printed on the back of dead Jews. So that's what Rabbi Weissmandl supposedly expressed himself. It's not in print, but everyone, you know, knows the famous story of Weissmandl was furious the Vahdat Salah did during the war. Now, the question anyone who examines, and I see actually a few things, so we're going to go to the end. Yeah, if I go 15 minutes, then I'll answer the questions and we'll finish. Right. The question anyone who examines the history of the Mir Yeshiva in Shanghai has to ask is, were the students at all influenced by their surroundings in other than a superficial way? And when I went to China to give my talk, that was what I was really supposed to speak about. Everything we've done until now has just been getting us to what I was going to speak about, but which I find even more interesting. And what I showed in my talk and I'll tell you now, is that I don't think there's any doubt the answer is no, for a couple of reasons. First of all, when dealing with an institution as conservative as a yeshiva, it takes a while before you see any evidence of outside influence. Furthermore, the influence, like you look at influence today in Israel, yeshiva students in America, it only takes place when yeshiva students really speak the local language and see themselves as part of the larger society, like you have in America and in Israel. The few years that the Mir students were in Shanghai were simply not long enough to speak of any real influence. These students and the local Jewish refugee community in general never learned Chinese. Not just the Jews, the locals never learned Chinese. And all of their official dealings with the Japanese authorities, they didn't learn Japanese either. The refugees preferred to learn English so that they would have a chance to immigrate to the United States. I remember Rabbi Shlomovitz, my teacher, saying the only thing he learned was how to count. in Chinese, as they need it for the laundry and things like that. It's worth noting, though, I will say that, because I was going to say it anyway, but since the eminent of time is with us, that his father, by Tzvi Zakheim, just say it right, Tzvi Zakheim, who already Vilna, had a law degree in Vilna. He was the legal advisor to not just to Rav Chaim Ozer, but also to the Vilna community, Jewish community as a whole. And he acted in Japan, in Shanghai, as the legal representative of the yeshiva reference with the Japanese authorities. He obtained a law certificate from Aurora University. That's the sister school for University of Scranton. I work at a university, Aurora University, which existed from 1903 to 1952 in Shanghai. It's a Jesuit institution, even 52, because of the communists. Rabbi Zakheim was unusual in that, he actually left the walls, as it were, and I'm sure could tell us all sorts of stories about his dealings as the legal representative of the refugees. But when you read the recollections of the students who were at the yeshiva, and not these students, the yeshiva, even the general, we have so many recollections, memoirs, so many people have written about this. And in a way, about these memoirs, one of the people who listened online said to me that when he went to the museum in China, there was hardly anything about the Mir Yeshiva. And his sense was the Mir Yeshiva was so central, the museum almost had nothing about it. It's not true that it's central. It's central for us, for our history. Most of the memoirs you read, in fact, almost all mention nothing about the Mir Yeshiva. 25,000 people there, refugees, and this is just it's a small group of Jews. Most of them were not religious at all. This had no influence at all. So larger scheme of things, when you read about the history of Jews in Shanghai, this is a tiny little episode. Kranzler, in his book, because he's an Orthodox Jew, and he's very interested in this, in his book here, so he has a number of pages on it, but the most of the book is also has nothing to do with the Mir Yeshiva. It's... yeah, you can look in the index here. What does he have? 10 pages or so on the Mir Yeshiva, 15 pages. He speaks about the Gemeinde there, the community, but it's a small aspect of the story as a whole. And so if you read the memoirs, the general memoirs, it's striking how absent the local Chinese are. The Chinese are all over. They're all around them. They're living among the Chinese. And yet there's no mentions of them except for people they would see on the streets, no relationship. It's very, I gather a couple exceptions to this, but generally you have no relationships whatsoever. There are a few examples of people who ended up working for a Chinese person, things like that, but most people had no relationship at all. And they couldn't speak to them, of course. That made it hard, difficult as well. The Japanese are always mentioned because they're the ruling authorities. But the Chinese are only mentioned in a superficial way. In one of the memoirs from the yeshiva, one of the yeshiva students, Hertzman, he writes with reference to the diseases rampant in Chinese, in Shanghai, especially in the Chinese sector of the city, quote, "The Chinese sector was the most contagious, and we feared to enter its district. It was also the most dangerous for robbery and murder. Not one of us ever entered there." Then in the ghetto, once they're in the ghetto, they're living among Chinese, but still, it's ships crossing in the night. Not much different, I think, than maybe Orthodox Jews living in Brooklyn, you could say today. The separation from the local Chinese population can be seen with regarding food, believe it or not. The Rabbi Shlomo Schwartzman, who lived in Shanghai, had nothing to do with Shiva, just it was an Orthodox rabbi there. And he recalled as follows: "The only time I had Chinese food was at a friend's wedding where the Russian trained cook made kosher suey." So here they lived in China for all these years. They never ate Chinese food either. Complete separation. The yeshiva students in this were no different than most of the refugee population, not to mention the upper class, what they called the one population, which had little to do with the local Chinese, who were the vast majority of the more than 4 million people who lived in Shanghai. And the yeshiva students knew that they were in Shanghai temporarily. They were not staying here. They were leaving as soon as they could. They had no interest in putting down roots and never engaged in any cultural, intellectual, or economic relationships with the Chinese. Others had economic relationships, not the yeshiva students. The communal leadership, however, which represented all the Jews, recognized that complete separation from the local community was not such a good thing. They recognized this before the war. And, in fact, in 1939, November of 1939, a school was established for Jewish refugee children, Jews from Austria and Germany, and they made a point of teaching Chinese so that at least the children could learn, together with English and French. After Pearl Harbor, they got rid of the English and French, and instead the school started teaching Japanese and German. Can you imagine teaching Jewish children German? In 1942, the three major communities in Shanghai, that's the Russian community, which goes back already after, even before World War I, but after World War I, they had the nice influx, the Sephardic community and the German community, which was the largest community, agreed that, you know something, we should try to have closer relationships with the Jews in the city. And they had a document where they spoke about, quote, educating the Jewish population, especially the newcomers, to a better understanding of the customs and peoples of Japan and China. And had they ended up living there another 10, 20 years, they would have developed in that way. Much like even if you take the most extreme group in America, like in the Satmar. So and for the first 10 years of the Satmar, they were completely separate. Now you go to Williamsburg, believe me, they're much more integrated. They listen to the radio, they're involved, they know everything that's going on. So it takes some time. I remember years ago, I used to go, I'm like an honorary Satmar. I have a lot of friends there. I've been to Curacao, Williamsburg, et cetera. I remember I'm going to mention in the next blog post something similar to this, but everyone who's listening now in the New York area in the 80s, and the 90s, and would drive home from work, and certainly remember Grant. Well, the Satmar would listen to Bob Grant too, and they'd know all that. But none of the endeavors that I just mentioned, teaching the kids in the school Chinese and Japanese and all that, had anything with the Mir Yeshiva. The Yeshiva was only focused on Torah study. In fact, in speaking about the Mir Yeshiva and its time in Shanghai, the important thing is how little connection they had with Chinese society. You know, it's common for writers to describe yeshivot as islands of Torah, removed from the concerns and activities of the outside world. And that's usually more of a hope, a wish, than a fact. Because anyone who knows anything about yeshivas knows that the guys in yeshivas are well aware of what goes on in the outside world. It's not an island. That's what the Russian yeshiva would like it to be, but it's not. On the other hand, in Shanghai, it really was an island. The yeshiva students had no connection. They didn't even speak the language. They couldn't know what's going on. So with this, we come to the end. It's been four classes. For those who haven't heard the earlier ones, you can hear them all online. I will now, whatever it is, it struck a chord because we got hundreds of people listening and emailing me stuff and all sorts. And I thank everyone who did. I'll get to the questions and comments now. It is a fascinating story. Before I take the questions and comments, just those who are interested, this is a book, Likal Lifrat, from Rabbi Nissim. It just came out last year. And this is volume two. If you look on page 170, three and on, the question is about from Harbin. In 1956, they didn't have a moel. And the question was, could a non-Jew do it? Could do the mila? And if so, what to do in that circumstance? And this is really the end of Jewish life. But even in 1956, there were Jews there who were interested in Torah and reached out to the chief rabbi, Yitzhak Nissen. So let me get to the questions now, and I hope the sound, if it could be my internet, was the problem. Okay, Kay Shiner asked, why should the Vada Tzolah have funded Chabad if they had their own fundraising effort? Exactly. That's what the Vada Tzolah's point was. I think Chabad's point was that, you know, they, I guess that they were not able to raise as much money, and they could have used the assistance. And Chabad pointed out that they helped in the years after World War One. Chabad helped Lithuanian yeshivas. I'm sorry again about the sound. It must be my internet. The Amchanover's daughter, Kay Shiner, says, married, is tuned to the Mir Yeshiva while they're in Shanghai. Yes. And you can see in the book, the Hebrew volume about the Mir, it has pictures of that wedding. Someone privately texted me that they have a set of the Shanghai Shas. Yeah, ghetto name is Hung Q. Someone else texts that their mother and parents lived there, and one person listening was born and lived in the ghetto. Another person, yes, Charlie Abdallah means servant of God, yes. It's not the only example of Arabic names for people from Iraq, from Tunisia, elsewhere. They use Arabic names. It's given name Zavadia, but they use it for like a Yiddish name, yeah. Okay, Mel says it got better when people turned off their video. Okay, what's the name of the collections of memoirs about Shanghai? There's a number of them. There's a woman, Maze, I forget her name, a British, from Iraqi descent in Britain, Maisley Meyer, I think. She has memoirs of the Sephardic community. There's a number of volumes. Woman asked, anything worthwhile on the book Shanghai Remembered? I know the book Shanghai Remembered. I didn't see anything for myself. What's the name of the memoir of the that criticizes the Mir Yeshiva during the war? Yes, the name is, it's by Sigmund Tobias, called Strange Haven. And what do we know about the Russia Yeshiva's point of view of this? I don't know what we know about the Russia Yeshiva. The Mir Yeshiva, they wanted to run a yeshiva. And they wanted the students lived in apartments. They had to give the students money. And, the student people gave tzedakah, obviously. You always gave tzedakah. I'm not sure what the criticism is that, other Jews in Shanghai were living worse. Just like today, there's people living worse than all of us. Does that mean that we have to give all of our money away so that other people can live the same level of us? The yeshiva students were fortunate in that there were people in America who believed in funding yeshivas. So they were supported by that, and they had it better than the people who were supported by the joint, who basically had no money or had to work as dishwashers and things like that. I don't really see the problem in that. It's not like the Mir students were living like kings, far from it, but they were living better than the, it's no different today. If you're in a yeshiva, let's say, and you get a stipend versus someone who doesn't have anyone. So I can't understand the, but you can understand the standpoint of the refugees, but look in retrospect, I don't see it. Hartman said that Samuel Sar died at the Chagasika. Okay, and his nephew was Rabbi Mordechai Gifter. I didn't know that. Okay. So Chaim Tzvi points out that Rabbi Weissman was it's famous that he's upset. I don't know legends that he pushed Rav Aaron Cutler down and he got in a physical fight with him after. These things expand and expand. Just like I don't know about when we have someone asked me about the evidence of Torah after the war. I don't have any documentation, but it's in the biography of Mordechai Ashkenazi, the grandson of Meir Ashkenazi, who's the Rav of Chabad. It's everyone in Chabad knows about this din Torah. So you have to be careful what's fact and then what becomes exaggerated. We know that Rabbi Weissmandel did not want that Vada Hatzalah, instead of sending money to Slovakia and places like where they could have used the money to rescue people, was sending money to Prince Shas and send money, I guess, so that the yeshiva students could get suits before Yontif. Whether how bad it was and whether it's true, I mean, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he was asked why he didn't go to the funeral of a color. He said because what he did to my father-in-law, which I don't, that sounds to me like a bug myself, because Reviron himself did not have this difficult relationship with Mayor Ashkenazi. It was Rav Kalmanovitz, I don't know. But Chaim, that's true. Rav Weissmandl was upset. Mutti asked, any Mir leave the yeshiva and stay in Shanghai and intermarry? I don't know of any Mir students who remained in Shanghai. Not only that, in all the wars, I don't know of any examples. None of them mention anyone actually taking up with a goal Chinese girl and remaining there, or even taking her home. They do mention young women. I could say they're prostitutes, but sort of mistress sort of things, pilagshim or something, who were involved with wealthy Chinese and with Japanese, but that would support their families. I don't know of any examples of anyone like that. How many Jews in total live there during the 25,000 year? More questions. Shmuley says that some are still listening to conservative talk radio. Why do they vote for leftist? They vote for leftist because they get the goodies, the government program. That's why they vote for it. But if you remember Bob Grant, I knew Satmar, so I knew people would listen to it. Believe me, there's plenty in Satmar who vote for leftists. You have a lot of wealthy people there. And if you think just because the Rebbe says to vote, they all listen to Rebbe. The Rabbanim leaders know what was happening in Europe. Everyone knew what was happening in Europe. If you go to the website, Torah in Motion, hear all the past lectures. And the good thing about the past lectures is the sound is perfect. No problem. Someone tells me they have a complete Shanghai Rambam. And someone has a Mishnah Brura from Shanghai. These are all valuable books. Keep old. Charlie, thank you. Oh. You all vote. 1,509 for Trump, 1,291 for Clinton. If the leadership is in charge, it wouldn't have been that. Yes, the leader vote for the liberals, sure. Okay, so now when David says, this is David, who I'll end with this, and if it's your first time on, I apologize. Sound has been perfect until now. I think it may be if the sound, if someone texts me, by the way, in the last 15 minutes, the sound still choppy, please text me. And if it is, if it hasn't been, then it's probably because of the video. But someone please text, let me know if the sound's been choppy. I can't.
A touch it's choppy, not too bad. A touch.
A touch, okay. But David Safier, the last comment, the last, what am I doing? Still choppy, I'm sorry. We will fix it for the next time. We have had a problem in a long, long time. A couple of years ago we did. It's just, it could just be my area today. I know that I was online in Scranton earlier today, and I wasn't sure if it was me or them. It was also choppy. Don't know what I'm doing next, but we'll have to speak to Rabbi
Edelman.
And Mutti says he has SMS for sale printed in Shanghai. So that, I thank you all. I hope you all found it of interest. I can tell you it was a thrill for me, because I couldn't believe all the people whose either themselves are born in Shanghai, whose parents were from Shanghai, who had Sugihara visas, Dov Zakheim today, whose father is an important figure in Shanghai, Nat Lewin for a few classes, who himself not only has a Sugihara visa, but as we determined, it was his mother and uncle who, his uncle and the mother from the Netherlands, they were the ones really to be the first to use, and his grandmother, to come up with the Curacao plan that was important. So I thank you all, and you'll find out when we have our next shows.
Yeah. I want to thank you, really. Thank you for this, and really wonderful. And as you say, I'll just all the crowds, and really a pleasure. As I mentioned in the beginning, we have about 200 talks of Dr. Shapiro, well worth listening to on Gedolim from the entire range that you can think of. I mentioned last week. So they're all on our website. You can go to our podcast page. You can go by program, by speaker. You can search. And everything's there to listen to. So I encourage people to listen. We've got a chance, all kinds of interesting Torah. So thank you. And we look forward to learning with Dr. Mark in the not too distant future.